Each year, August 26 marks the anniversary of the adoption in 1920 of the 19th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution that granted women the right to vote. Today's episode of Writer's Voice features two women who were important to the fight for women's suffrage, but whose names are less known than those of Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony. The first woman we talk about is Inez Milholland.
Well, Inez Milholland is my hero, my heroine. She's the one who rode the horse, and that was in 1913. She rode the horse at the head of the parade, and there were thousands of people in the parade, and then tens of thousands lined the streets. It was the eve of Woodrow Wilson's inauguration, and they were trying to get Woodrow Wilson to support what they called the Anthony Amendment, which was to give women a federal amendment that would ensure that women could vote.
That's John Tepper Marlin. Milholland was his great aunt, and he's the author of a play about the women's suffrage movement. It's called Take Up the Song. Then we replay our 2007 interview with writer Marge Piercy about her novel Sex Wars. It's about another great figure of the first women's equality movement, Victoria Woodhull, the first woman to run for president. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. While visiting a neighbor the other day, I happened to notice a striking poster framed on the wall. It pictured a young woman robed in white, riding proudly on a horse and carrying a banner. The poster identifies her as Inez Milholland Boissevain, who, quote, died for the freedom of women. I asked my neighbor, John Tepper Marlin, about the poster, and he told me Milholland was his great aunt. She was a famous suffragette who was known as the fairest of the Amazons by her admiring contemporaries. It turned out that Marlin has written a play about the women's suffrage movement, and as this week celebrates the anniversary of the 19th Amendment granting women the right to vote, I sat down with him to talk about that movement and his play, Take Up the Song. It's been performed in New York City, Rochester, New York, and Virginia, as well as elsewhere. John Tepper Marlin is the former chief economist for the Comptroller of New York City and the founder and president of Boissevain Books, a small publishing house in New York. So, Inez Milholland?
Inez Milholland. Her father was an Irish immigrant, second generation, but he was born in Derry in Northern Ireland. He bought a lot of property in upstate New York in Lewis, New York. He got a start as editor of the Ticonderoga paper. He went to NYU, and he was way ahead of his time. He was a suffrage advocate. He worked for Horace Greeley on the Tribune. Horace Greeley was a major figure of the 19th century in New York City. He was the editor of the New York Tribune, which became the Herald Tribune. And the Milholland brothers, one of them was an editor, that was John Milholland, and the other was the head of the Printers Union. And surprise, surprise, John Milholland settled a strike and became, as a result, a very important figure in the publishing world.
So now you have a personal connection to Inez Milholland. Tell us what that is.
Yes. Well, Inez Milholland is my hero, my heroine. She's the one who rode the horse, and that was in 1913. She rode the horse at the head of the parade, first in New York City, and then in Washington, D.C. This was the famous parade, largest parade ever in Washington. And there were thousands of people in the parade, and then tens of thousands lined the streets. It was the eve of Woodrow Wilson's inauguration, and they were trying to get Woodrow Wilson to support what they called the Anthony Amendment, which was to give women a federal amendment that would ensure that women could vote.
So this parade, when did it happen, and why was it called the Anthony Amendment?
The Anthony Amendment was Susan B. Anthony, something Susan B. Anthony championed. Now, of course, the original Seneca Falls Convention was in 1848, and Anthony didn't really join the movement till 1851. But she worked with Elizabeth Cady Stanton for years in the various changes of the women's organizations, which eventually became NAWSA, NAWSA, the National American Women's Suffrage Association. There were two rival groups, and they merged after the Civil War when they realized that African-Americans were going to get the vote, African-American men were going to get the vote, but not women of either of any race or color. And they came together because they realized there was no longer any issue separating them that was important. What was important was they should work as hard as they could to get this Anthony Amendment passed.
So now, fast forward, give us the date of that march in which your ancestress, your great aunt rode a horse in Washington, D.C.
Right. 1913, and she was at the head of the parade, and she is, by the way, she married in July. She wasn't expected to marry. She was a suffragist, and the suffragists were assumed to be, like Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, they were assumed to be women who were rejected for marriage and never married. They devoted themselves to these, quote, causes. And the surprising thing was that she got married to my mother's uncle in July, and she only met him in June. So
wow.
It took everyone by surprise, including her father, who didn't know. He didn't know that his daughter had married until he read it in the New York Times.
That must have been a shock. Now, her husband was fairly well disposed to her activities as a suffragette. Is that correct?
Yes. He was my uncle Eugene Boissevin was my grandmother's brother. And he had been analyzed by Jung. And, of course, Jung is all about the little bit of men, the male and the female. The Korean flag shows it. It's the yin and the yang. There's a bit of yin and a yin in every yang and a bit of yang in every yin. So he was very well disposed to the idea that you don't have to be tough to be a man. It doesn't hurt to be strong and so forth, but he had that side to him that women liked. He was quite a popular man.
So tell us a little bit about your great aunt. What was she like? And what kind of stories did you hear about her when you were growing up?
My mother, of course, knew her. My mother was a young woman. She died in 1916, you have to understand. She died after 3 years. And I would like to say I'm more than 100 years old, but I'm not. I mean, I hope I live that long. But she was my mother thought she was, she said she smelled of lavender. She was considered by the New York Times in an editorial said that Inez Mille Holland was, quote, the fairest of the Amazons. Although her name was Mille Holland, she was nothing Dutch about her, and so they made something of the New York Times made a joke of the fact that she was Irish, but he was named Holland, but he was a Dutchman. But in fact, they met in Holland House, which was then the equivalent of the Waldorf Astoria. It was a major restaurant in a hotel in New York. And so my mother's feeling about her was that she was very attentive to her. She gave her a Cupid doll as a present.
She gave your mother a Cupid
doll? She gave my mother, when they first met, she gave my mother a Cupid doll. And, you know, showed great sympathy for children. She would have been a great mother, but she died in 19. And, of course, they didn't have children. They wanted children desperately. And their correspondence keeps talking about the fact that even though she was sick, her doctor said there was no problem about having children. And this was in one of her letters. I have all of her letters, and I've read them all more than once, and they're very sad in the sense that when you know what the end of her travel to the West was, that you know they all have more meaning in retrospect. She would write from her different whistle stop speeches. She went around to the West to convince the women who voted in the territories. In none of the states had votes for women until later, but in 1916, New York State gave the vote to women in 1917. 1916, the votes were all in the West, the territories, and the pioneer women were considered the equal of men, and they got to vote. So, Inez did was to go to the West and say, vote for a federal amendment so that, you know, you can vote now, because it was then all done by states' rights. You can vote. Please vote for, please don't vote for Wilson because he won't support the amendment. This is 1916. That was a re-election campaign. And the campaign slogan of Wilson was, he kept us out of war. And the answer of the women was, he kept us out of suffrage because he didn't support the Anthony Amendment. And it is true that as soon as the president came around, after much pain among the women, I mean, which we can talk about if you want, after much pain and suffering by women, he finally came around and gave his support to the Anthony Amendment, and within very quickly, the House passed the bill, and after a while, the Senate passed the bill, and then the ratification occurred 100 years ago this year in August. We're coming up right up on the 100th anniversary in August of 1917.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with John Tepper Marlin about women's suffrage. His great-aunt, Inez Mulholland, was a key figure in the suffrage movement, and his play about the movement is Take Up the Song. So before we get to kind of how this came about on the federal level, this is the first time I've heard that women actually had the right to vote in different states.
Right. And I should say that Inez Mulholland died on her speaking tour, and women were devastated because she collapsed in October in Los Angeles, and in November she died.
And what happened? Why did she die? What did she have?
She had an illness that was treated by a dubious number of doctors along the way. Now, I don't want to attack doctors, but they were giving her prescriptions for strychnine and arsenic, which was then, you know, considered to be okay in terms of curing you. I guess the idea was the strychnine and the arsenic would poison the whatever bug or whatever bad thing was in your body. But I can't believe that it was very helpful for her. She probably died of a B12 deficiency, B but they hadn't, the vitamins had not yet been fully sorted out. And I think vitamin B12 was certainly not arrived at yet. And so they didn't know what she had, and so they couldn't treat it. They gave her transfusions, and who knows, now we know a lot more about blood and what the dangers of transfusions. She had lots of people who volunteered. If you look at the New York Times for the years 1913 to 1916, and even before, the number of times Inez Milholland is mentioned is staggering, because they gave daily bulletins. I'm just citing the New York Times because they have a very good index, but all the newspapers. She was in every newspaper. She was the best known suffragist in America without any doubt.
And why was that?
That was because she was attractive, because she cut such a figure on the horse in 1913, because she was a good speaker, because she spoke, because she would come forward. And her father was a newspaper man, and she knew her way around the newspaper world. And she was a very effective spokesperson. And even though other people were sort of heads of these organizations, Alice Paul was head of the Congressional Union, as was originally called. It became later the National Woman's Party. But the funding for that came from Alva Belmont in New York. A lot of the funding for the activist women came from a few sources in New York City, and one of them was Alva Belmont. She was very important. Alva Belmont Vanderbilt. And she was married to two men who were very wealthy, and so when she was divorced or they died, she became very wealthy, and she liked to support women, female women's causes. She also, by the way, supported others in the same kind of movement. In other words, I'm pretty sure she was a major donor to John Reed's trip to Russia.
John Reed, who was a radical, wasn't he the one who published the magazine, yes, The Masses?
No.
Or was it a different?
That was Max Eastman, but they were friends. They were part of the same group. Max Eastman was, I'm sure he was involved in The Masses, but Max Eastman is one who's was also a friend of Inez. Remember, she had lots of fans. She had many men who, Sinclair Lewis was, Upton Sinclair, I'm thinking of. Upton Sinclair was one of them, and he proposed by mail. I mean, it's hard to imagine how much she was a focus of attention, because she's been forgotten. And one reason she's been forgotten is that, they got the vote. I mean, and the people who got the vote, she wasn't there when they got the vote, although her sister Vida was there. Her sister Vida was part of the group that picketed the White House. Now, what they did after she died is they went to a meeting with President Wilson. They said, Inez Milholland has died. Would you now support the Anthony Amendment? And he said, you women are so... He looked scornful. He said, you women are so naive. You have no idea about how the political system works. Why don't you go back and do your homework? That's not how this system works. I'm a Democrat, and my supporters are in the South. And they've just had this federal amendment giving black men the vote, and they don't like it. I'm telling you, they don't like it. Now you want me to give another federal amendment, which will enfranchise more black people, the black women that are going to be enfranchised down there, probably going to cause more trouble than the men. And I can tell you right now, they don't want this down there, and I'm not going to lose the support of the South from the Democratic Party. I'm just going to tell you right now. So why don't you do your homework and figure it out and work state by state? You're going to, and maybe you'll get somewhere, but forget it. I'm not going to lead this thing. I believe in states' rights. So they were so angry, they went back and they decided they were going to start picketing the White House from then on. Now, that was very unusual then. I don't think you're going to find any picket effort before, ever, like that. They stood in front of the White House. They were called themselves the Silent Sentinels. Now, it was very convenient because the National Women's Party was located right across Lafayette Square. And the White House only had one gate now between them, and it was a public access. So it was different. It's different now, by the way, if you go there. But you could stand right in front of the White House gates, and people would walk in front of you, and you could hand out leaflets, and it was a very good place to be. And everyone would see you. The cars were driving in front. And they really got to Wilson. He was very upset about this. And he must have put out the word to the D.C. police, why don't you do something? Because they came in and started putting women in paddy wagons. And at first they put them in a local jail. And they got visits from everybody. And then they said, let's put them in the Lorton Reformatory and make them suffer. Because they wouldn't get so many visitors, they thought, because they would be in Virginia, which was then part of the district, I guess. They gave it back to Virginia. Anyway, so they went to the Lorton Reformatory, workhouse they called it, and they had been trained by the Pankhursts in England, in London.
Who were the Pankhursts?
The Pankhursts, their mother and daughter. They were suffragists in London, and they were very activist. Their attitude was, if you won't listen to our case for women's suffrage, we're going to stop. We're going to make sure you can't do any other. We're going to heckle you in speeches. We're going to cause trouble.
You're listening to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon, and I'm talking with John Tepper Marlin about the movement to give women the vote in the U.S. and the courageous women who carried on that fight despite terrible abuse and even imprisonment. And they were jailed and they were beaten up.
They were jailed, and they started, what they did in jail was, in order to seize the offensive, they went on a hunger strike. See, once you're in jail, you know, they figure they've got you, you're not going to, you can't do anything. Well, they could. They could go on a hunger strike. And in fact, that is how the whole effort succeeded, because they were put in jail, and they went on a hunger strike, and they were supposed to be there for 30 days, and they said, we're going to go on a hunger strike. And they drove the people who ran this prison nuts. They didn't want someone to die on them. You know, some of these women were quite respectable. I mean, a lot of them were very respectable. Dorothy Day was one of them. She was very well known.
I mean, Dorothy Day, the Catholic worker activist?
The Catholic worker activist who's being considered to be a saint. Dorothy Day was there, and Lucy Burns and Alice Paul, both of whom headed up the National Women's Party, and Vida Milholland, who was Inez's sister. You know, there was quite a bunch of them.
So now you're talking about the American women.
Now we're talking about the American women, but they had Lucy Burns and Alice Paul and Inez Milholland and Vida Milholland. All four of them had trained with the Pankhursts. So they knew what they did. They were these. That's why they called themselves suffragettes, ETTES, suffragettes. You know, they'll tell you that you don't use that word in America, that it's only an English word. That is not true. One of the articles that Inez wrote was, "Why I Am a Suffragette." And the reason is she was a suffragette was that she believed in activism. So you seize the offensive. You don't let the wardens tell you that you're now going to be peaceful and quiet. You go on a hunger strike. You don't eat their food. What did they do? They got a doctor to come in and force feed them. And Lucy Burns wrote a letter that was smuggled out. And it appeared in all the newspapers about how her throat was, you know, the blood coming out of her nose. They put, and that her food was deposited in her stomach. It felt like lead. You know, all this stuff about what it feels like to be force-fed, like a goose in the Dordogne. And that had a huge effect. People said, what are they doing? These women are really serious about getting the vote. And, you know, why not? What's the problem? And Wilson came around. He said, my goodness, we've lost this issue. The newspapers went berserk. The mainstream media kept showing all these smuggled out letters, and Wilson changed his mind.
My final question is, for you, you did all this research. This is your own relative. Yeah. Through doing this and writing this play, what was the most important takeaway you got for it, for your own life?
Well, I guess what I take away from the whole, from my play and from what they all did is, number one, you really can make a difference. And it was just a few women who really made, to my mind, the difference. Although you can't overlook all the work that NASA had been doing for years. In other words, it takes steady pressure, and it also takes maybe a major effort to put you over the top. And I think the New York Times awarded a gold pen to what became the League of Women Voters, NASA, and they gave a silver inkstand to the National Women's Party. But the other takeaway is, you know, so many people have fought to get the vote, you know, and now it's so disappointing when you read the figures on people who don't vote. And I think the issues, the stakes are pretty high. And my takeaway is, I hope it sends a message that we all should vote.
So, John Marlin, I want to thank you so much for sharing your own personal history, the history of the women's suffrage movement, and telling us about your play on Writer's Voice.
Right. Thanks so much.
John Tepper Marlin is the author of the play Take Up the Song, about the women's suffrage movement. Go to writersvoice.net to read a piece he wrote about his illustrious great-aunt, suffragette Inez Milholland, for the East Hampton Star. He's the founder and president of Boissevain Books, a small publishing house in New York. Next up, we go back a decade to my 2007 interview with author Marge Piercy about her novel Sex Wars. It's about another great figure of the first wave of the women's equality movement in the U.S., Victoria Woodhull. Stay tuned after the break.
In my Margaret, she become the suffragette. My heart is the one she breaks. She wears the pants that kill a romance all day. Daffy like a dilly, poor old wop. Oh, to my eyes come the big teardrop. No more I eat the spaghetti, my Margaret, become the suffragette. That's all right. Since my Margaret, she become the suffragette. She said to me, hey, Tony, play me a little Spanish. I want to shoot at the bull. Since Margaret, she got the habit. No more, I got the home like a rabbit. Poor Antone, he must sleep with the monk alone. Like busy bee, I make the honey. She call me treasure and take the money. My bank book lip gets so small like the shrimp. In my business, she put one a big cream. Since my Margaret, she become the top forget. My heart is the one she breaks. She wearing the pants that kill a romance all day. That be like a dilly poor old wop. Oh, to my eyes come the big teardrop. No more I eat spaghetti since my Margaret become a suffragette.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. August 26 marks the anniversary of the adoption in 1920 of the 19th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution that granted women the right to vote. In our first segment today, we spoke with John Tepper Marlin about his illustrious great-aunt, suffragette Inez Mulholland. Back in 2007, we spoke with well-known author and novelist Marge Piercy about another great figure of the women's suffrage movement, Victoria Woodhull. Woodhull is the main character in Piercy's novel Sex Wars, and she was the first woman to run for president. Back in 2007, we aired that interview in honor of International Women's Day, March 8th. Let's listen back to my conversation with Marge Piercy. March 8th is International Women's Day, which has been observed since 1909, when the Socialist Party of America first declared National Women's Day. It arose from a time of extraordinary activism around the issue of equal rights for women, the first American feminist movement, with such leaders as Susan B. Anthony, Victoria Woodhull, and Elizabeth Cady Stanton. These historical figures are some of the major characters in my guest Marge Piercy's latest work of fiction, Sex Wars, a novel of the turbulent post-Civil War period. In this richly imagined book set in New York City during the Gilded Age, Piercy explores the changing attitudes towards women, minorities, religion, and sexuality. Marge Piercy is one of America's preeminent novelists, poets, and feminist authors. Others of her novels include He, She, and It, City of Darkness, City of Light, and Woman on the Edge of Time. I recorded our interview with Piercy in November 2005. Well, this book, Sex Wars, it has a cast of characters that are both historical and fictional. I wonder if you could talk about some of the main characters that figure in this book.
Well, there's Elizabeth Cady Stanton. Now, oftentimes when people think of the first wave of feminism, two things happen. One is they confuse the suffragists with the first wave. That was sort of a wave and a half. It was much more narrowly focused than the earlier. And second, they think of Susan B. Anthony. Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony were very close friends, but their interests were often different. Elizabeth Cady Stanton was a very brilliant thinker, a good writer. She was a wonderful speaker. She was a very charming woman. She had seven children. She had a very active and happy sex life. She identified with women and women's physicality much more than Susan B. Anthony did. She also was very interested in a number of issues which put off other women sometimes in the movement, which was divorce, child custody, contraception. And she and Susan B. Anthony were both very involved with trying to unionize women, trying to help working women.
And you also talk about a fascinating character who, I have to say, was new to me, and that's Victoria Woodhull.
Victoria Woodhull was the free love feminist, so a lot of feminists haven't wanted particularly to claim her, but she was an extremely intelligent woman. I've read her speeches and her writings. She and her sister came out of utter poverty. They came to New York, and they succeeded in snaring Cornelius Vanderbilt, the richest man in the United States, as their sponsor. They were the first women stockbrokers. They made their own money. They started a newspaper that was quite successful and very radical. It was the first thing to publish Marx in the United States.
Really?
Yeah, the Communist Manifesto was published in it. It was the first translation in English in the States. She ran for president. She was a very interesting woman. She came out of the background of being a medium, you know, putting contact with the spirits. That was big at that time for several reasons. First of all, as opposed to Hell and Fire Brimstone, of the sort that one of the other characters, Anthony Comstock, whom I'll get to in a minute, loved, the spiritual movement was much more positive. Now, women had generally lost about half their children in childhood. Infant mortality and childhood mortality was extremely high. Elizabeth Cady Stanton was very unusual in that she had seven children and lost none of them. Her mother had lost half of her children. That was common. And also the Civil War had killed an enormous number of young men. So every family had a lot of mortality in it. And the spiritualism offered them a way of contacting these people and a whole theory of how the next life was better, and they were moving on, and they were on a different plane of existence, and, you know, were progressing and happy and so forth, and but still interested in them. So it was very comforting to men and women, but especially women, at a time when there was so much death in every family. Then, let's see, the other characters are Anthony Comstock. You might never have heard of him before, but you have been acquainted with his effects.
Well, the Comstock laws
are still on the books.
That's right. Well, tell us what the Comstock laws were.
The Comstock laws were laws he wrote. He had a lot of very wealthy, powerful men behind him who, first of all, did not want their sons being too interested in pleasure as opposed to business. And second, who were very nervous about their workers drinking too much or having too much fun or not paying enough attention on the job. They really worried a lot about morality in a sort of economic way. And also a lot of them were very fierce evangelical born-again Christians.
Yes, what struck me really about the chapters about Comstock and also about how you bring some of these different characters together are really the strong parallels to our own time. What are some of the differences and what are some of the similarities that you see here? And is this part of why you wrote the book?
Yes, that was what attracted me to that era, and that was what attracted me. I'd always wanted to write about Elizabeth Cady Stanton, but I'd never quite seen a way to do it that was interesting enough to me. But when I began to study the times a bit, I began to see so many parallels, even down to the election of 1876 between Rutherford B. Hayes and Samuel Tilden, which was stolen in Florida.
Really?
Yes. Rutherford B. Hayes was minority president.
Very interesting parallels here.
Very funny. Anyhow, the third character is Freda. Freda is an immigrant from the Pale. The Pale of Settlement is the area in the Russian Empire under the Tsar where Jews were permitted to live rather crowded together, impoverished, and always in danger. Now, not too many Jews from the Pale had emigrated at that point. Most of the immigrants were from Germany, and their culture was very different. They didn't even speak Yiddish. They spoke German.
Right.
She is an early immigrant, and she's also a very young widow. She lost her husband, whom she loved. She is a woman, a very pragmatic woman, who decides that one of the ways that she can make money and get out of utter poverty is by manufacturing condoms. Condoms were big then as they are now, but up until then they'd been only made by men because they were connected with butchering. They were made out of intestines or lambskin beaten very fine. But with the beginning of rubber condoms, women could vulcanize rubber in their kitchen and make condoms. So it became a kitchen industry that women could make money at.
So this really was a common thing that women did? And how,
yes.
How did you find out about this?
I do a lot of research.
Mm-hmm.
I do all my own research, and I do a hell of a lot of it.
In fact, I was really struck because my own family came from the Pale, although they did come in that later migration in 1903, and you really make the world of Freda come alive. I mean, I felt that this was a world that was very familiar to me, and I was surprised to see it delineated in such wonderful, rich detail in your book. So say something about the research that you did, even particularly about Freda.
Well, first of all, my own family gives me a lot of that information. My grandmother was an incredible storyteller. She came from there, and I was very close to her in my childhood. Also, there's a lot of memoirs and there's a lot of writing about it. And I read a great deal of it.
So when did your grandmother come over?
She came over in the 1890s.
Wow. And, you know, in fact, I think a lot of Jews in this country did come from the Pale. So it was a terrifically oppressive place and
yes,
time.
It really was, and it got worse.
Right.
In any event, okay. So, and because she lost her own child when her husband was killed, she collects. There are all these homeless children on the streets of all the cities, but every place in the United States at that time. But in New York alone, there were thousands and thousands of thrown away children. And she begins collecting them out of compassion, out of this. She builds herself a family. She has no interest in marrying again. And as she proceeds with her own ability to sustain herself and, you know, and make money and build this a foundation, she doesn't want to give up her autonomy. And she builds a family out of the children she collects.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Marge Piercy about her novel, Sex Wars. It's about the first American feminist movement during the Gilded Age. Right, that's so wonderful that she takes a couple of street urchins, as a matter of fact. I mean, this is a very warm and intimate kind of a picture. I mean, I think you delineate the characters in a very marvelous way, but most of them are historical, and Freda is fictional. Was there any kind of difference in how you felt in writing about the two of them, and some of perhaps restrictions or limitations in terms of the historical ones that you didn't have to observe with the fictional?
Probably that's not true to some extent, insofar as, you know, you can't send your characters off. I mean, and into, you know, Elizabeth Cady Stanton can't decide to marry again or move to Hawaii or something. You know,
right?
You have her life, but what you choose to emphasize when you enter a character, whether it's a historical character or one you've invented to be historical, getting inside them is the same kind of discipline to understand them. And of course, the hardest one for me to get into was Anthony Comstock.
Why is that?
Because I didn't like him. But I think I managed to get into him and to make him real, too, so that you understand who he was and what he was dealing with.
I think you did, and I really felt, you know, there's a certain place where he loses his own child. And, you know, I wonder if he were a fictional character, would you have gone in a different direction than the one you did? Do you think you would have humanized him more, or would you have made the same choices as he made in his real life?
I think that, you know, I humanize him insofar as coming to understand how he saw the world and why certain things upset him greatly and why other things pleased him greatly.
Right. Now, back to Victoria Woodhull, one of the things that struck me about her is that she's kind of the quintessential... She has that quintessential American trait, and that is of reinvention.
Totally. She reinvents herself every few years.
That's right.
Including toward the end of the novel. She's reinventing herself very successfully all over again in England.
Right. She survives the total loss of her fortune. She's in jail, and she manages to kind of pull it out at the very end, which, of course, we won't reveal, and go on to a life of fame and fortune, in fact.
She was absolutely resilient. She was a courageous woman. She was, as I said, intelligent. She was also beautiful, which helps. And she was a fine public speaker. She spoke on her feet very eloquently. She and Elizabeth Cady Stanton both had that characteristic. It was very important at that time. Now we're used to sign bites. Then people loved oratory. They loved to hear fine speeches. That was one of the great entertainments of the time, was going to hear speakers.
It would be nice to be able to have speakers like that in these days.
No one pays attention long enough.
That's probably
Can
true.
Can you imagine listening to a speech that's 2 hours long?
Not in this country.
No. I mean, that was one of the great entertainments, both in church, on the lecture stage. Lectures at the Lyceum Circuit was extremely important. And that was another way that a woman, if she was a good speaker, like both of them, could make money. Women had been forbidden to speak in public. When the Grimke sisters began giving speeches for abolition, it was tremendously shocking. However, the breakthrough was with mediums, with women through whom the spirit spoke. Now, since it was the spirit speaking through them, and the spirits are very, you know, important and higher beings and so forth, who could object?
Hold on, Ed. You're saying that it was actually mediumship that introduced women as public speakers?
Yes.
Wow.
Because actresses were on a level with prostitutes. No, but mediums were highly respected. The spiritual movement was, in large part, a movement of strong women.
Now, do you think, Victoria, I mean, I kind of get the feeling that there's a little blurring of the line between reality or real spiritualism and fakery here with Victoria Woodhull. I mean, do you have some...
Yes, I very intentionally wrote it that way because I think that's how it was. Mm-hmm. I think that... That she truly believed in the spirits, but she also saw no reason not to fake it a bit. After all, she says, it pleases people, and people can't bear too much reality.
Right.
She says that about one of her husbands, if you recall.
Yes. But now, you know, one of the things that struck me in this book, too, is that the title Sex Wars doesn't just refer to the sex wars that were playing out across the political landscape in terms of these large social movements, but also very much within the personal lives of the characters themselves.
Yes, I thought this is one title that I chose. Oftentimes, the publisher gives a title to my novels that isn't the one I would choose. But in this particular novel, I chose the title, and I wanted that ambiguity.
And now these guys, these Americans of the Victorian age, I have to say, were a pretty raunchy lot.
They were indeed. Our notion of the Victorians. Now, it's true that there were a lot of straight-laced Victorians who referred to piano limbs rather than legs and so forth. But there was also a tremendous sexual, not particularly underground. There were a lot of churches. There were also a lot of brothels. There were at least as many brothels as churches. There was this whole sporting life phenomenon of the young men who came to the cities and who had their newspapers and their whole world of glamorizing prostitution, gambling, running articles about their favorite whorehouses, the world of illegal boxing, terriers, rat catching, dog fights, cock fights, all of that, gambling, drinking, you know, so this was a whole huge thing. And pornography was an enormous industry then, as it is now. It was very common. You walk into most bookstores then, you would see pornography openly displayed.
In most bookstores?
Yes.
And you also had, well, among the progressives of their era, that is the folks who were part of the abolition movement and the women's movement, including men, I mean, there was an awful lot of, you know, shall we say, extramarital sex going on?
Yes. There was a lot of passionate affinities.
Is that what they were called?
That's one of the things they were called, yes.
That's a lovely term.
It was our notion of what the initial wave of the women's movement and the abolitionist, because they started, you know, there was a lot of crossbreeding between them and people were active in both of them. You know, we think of Susan B. Anthony.
Yeah.
But there were an awful lot of women in it who were, and men who were quite... Well, they had a wandering eye. They had passionate affinities outside their marriage. They had affairs. They had, you know, they were not very straight-laced in their private lives. Now, they may or may not, a lot of this was quite secret, but everybody knew about it. It was secret but known about at the same time.
And there was some scandal with Henry Ward, who...
Yes. Harriet Beecher Stowe's brother, Henry Ward Beecher, was the most... He was like the most important televangelist of nowadays. He was the preeminent Protestant preacher in the whole United States. There was a whole industry built around him. He recommended soaps, he recommended liniments and so forth, and he was published books, which he largely didn't write. And he was the gospel of love.
I see.
Which he practiced with a number of his female practitioners, female congregation.
With great gusto.
Yes. The trouble is, he had an affair with the wife of his ghostwriter, Theo Tilton. He had an affair with him, and Theo found out about it. Though he was having affairs and passionate affinities, it was not right for his wife to, and he absolutely blew up.
And actually had an affair with Victoria Woodhull.
Yes.
Right, so the circle closes there.
Oh, yes. All the circles close. Everybody mm-hmm. has to do with everybody before the novel is over.
Right, including Comstock, who got involved in this as well.
Yes.
And we're talking with Marge Piercy about her novel, Sex Wars. So I want to go back, though, to this point that you made about Henry Ward Beecher being the televangelist of his age, because that brings up another, actually a contrast, and that is how religion played not only a repressive role, as in the case of the figure of Comstock, Anthony Comstock, but also played a very progressive role. Evangelism played a very progressive role at that time.
Not necessarily evangelism. The spiritual movement was very progressive. And he was sort of moving in that the gospel of love was his, you know, his invention.
But wasn't the abolition movement kind of connected with the evangelist movement as
well?
Yeah,
and also with spiritualism.
I see. Now, I got to ask you about one very small detail that really intrigued me, and I just really wonder how you found this. This was the clove remedy that Victoria Woodhull gives to a madam Victoria Woodhull.
I read about that.
Okay, so where did you read about it? Tell us what that is.
There's a whole lot of books on contraception and sexuality and, you know, I found that was in one of the books.
Tell our listeners what that was.
Victoria Woodhull, when she's getting started in New York, before she, you know, starts making money, sells a number of preparations to the brothels, and one of them was a preparation using clove, which, of course, the anointing the right area would make a woman seem quite hot and would also numb her slightly. If there's a lot of traffic, might really help her.
Yeah, so that was quite a little trick there. You have all kinds of amazing, amazing detail in this book. You say you do all your own research.
Yep.
Did it take you a long time to research?
I started researching this novel while I was writing the last one, The Third Child. Often when I do the novels that require a lot of research, I start researching them while I'm writing a simpler novel.
What are some of the tips that you might give our listeners about how you go about doing research as a writer as opposed to being a scholar?
Well, I know that some writers use research assistants or people to do their research. I think that's a terrible mistake because you can never tell unless you do your own research. You won't find those funny telling little details, those little things that make everything real
right.
for the reader.
Do you go about it, you think, the same way a scholar might, or are you looking for, do you think you're looking for some different things? Do you go to some different kinds of places? How do you think it's different for you?
Well, I use fiction of the time to get into the mindset of people, which a scholar might or might not do. But, you know, doing research it's pretty much the same doing the actual research, but what I'm looking for may be quite different.
Say more about that.
Well, I want to be able to get into the characters. I want to know how they thought. I want to know how they felt. I want to know how they saw things. And I also want to know a whole lot about the details of daily life, how things smelled, how things sounded, how things felt.
Do you feel that as you do this, that you go through your own kind of process of transformation?
What do you mean? I don't understand. Do I become Anthony Comstock? No.
No, not in that sense. Not that you become your character, but that you inhabit maybe more fully the life that they might have lived, or the world they might have lived in.
Well, I think that without the kind, without period details, you can't.
Mm-hmm.
You can't get into them.
Right.
The more you can imagine your way into them physically, the more you can make them real.
It reminds me, it's almost a process of mediumship. The way you talk about it with Victoria Woodhull, it's almost as if, in fact, when I was reading much of this, I felt like you were channeling this time.
I don't know if I believe in channeling.
Well, I'm not. I don't actually believe in channeling myself. But in this, but in the sense that, but let's say perhaps in the not in the literal sense, but in the figurative sense.
Well, you try to make it as real as possible for the reader, so that they can fully enter the characters. In a novel like this, where you have four viewpoint characters and many other characters, the each person who reads the novel will experience a different novel. Some people will identify with Victoria Woodhull, some people with Elizabeth Cady Stanton, some people with Freda, and presumably some people will even identify with Comstock. And it will feel very different to depending on where you situate yourself in the story. But to me, the truth of the novel comes together not on the page, but in the mind of the reader when they put together the different viewpoints and the different truths of the different characters.
Right. Well, it certainly did, Marge Piercy. It is a wonderful book. I have to say I read it in one sitting.
Oh, my God.
I did. I got up at about 7 in the morning, and I don't think I got to bed until about 11 o'clock that night, but it was time well spent. The novel is Sex Wars, a novel of the turbulent post-Civil War period, and it's by Marge Piercy. And thank you so much, Marge Piercy, for speaking with us today.
Well, thank you for having me on your program.
Marge Piercy is the author of numerous books, including the novels Woman on the Edge of Time, Vida, and Gone to Soldiers. She's also a poet and memoirist. You can browse inside her novel Sex Wars by going to writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.